Badlines pressure is building up on UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to call it quits as back-to-back cabinet resignations rock his government. Ukraine is calling on the civilian population in Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian forces close in on the city. Also ahead, a 20-year-old Palestinian man becomes the latest victim of Israeli gunfire in the West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour in the UK: ruling Conservative Party lawmaker Chris Skidmore submits a letter of no confidence in Prime Minister Boris Johnson as a wave of resignations rocks his government. Skidmore also calls for changes to his party's regulations in order to call for another confidence vote on leadership. That after three cabinet ministers and two junior ministers stepped down in 24 hours, raising speculations that the Johnson government is on the brink of collapse. Two of the resigning ministers have said they could no longer tolerate the culture of scandals. Johnson has been under pressure since the Partygate scandal, when he and some of his aides breached COVID lockdown rules. Robin Walker, a junior minister who also tendered his resignation, says he believes the party has been distracted from its core mission under Johnson. Our London correspondent Robert Carter joined us with the latest on the resignation of ministers and challenges out of Prime Minister Johnson.
There's no doubt about it. This news is absolutely devastating for the embattled Prime Minister. This concept of, is he the right man for the job? Will he still be in his position going forward for much longer? This has plagued him for months now, even before the no confidence vote against him last month, which took place, where 148 ministers of his own party members, his own MPs, voted against him in that motion. However, these are very senior resignations, very important key members of his cabinet, including the Treasury Chief, who has resigned during a cost of living crisis. How Boris Johnson is going to navigate that at this time, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly the question of whether he can survive this latest round of resignations will have to be seen. There are actual pundits in British media circles now that are actually basically throwing in the towel for the Prime Minister, suggesting that he should probably consider going soon. I even saw on, I think it was Talk TV, there was a pundit close to the Conservative Party who suggested that he'd be surprised to see the Prime Minister last longer than, say, this weekend.
A walkout by railway staff over pay has disrupted train travel and caused commuter chaos around France. Strikes called by four train unions have caused the cancellations of around a quarter of high-speed trains. The unions are demanding negotiations over salaries amid rising inflation. The state-owned railway company has recommended travelers to cancel or delay their trips, saying the disruptions may continue until Thursday morning. The National Traffic website for highways has also posted a warning about extremely heavy traffic in the coming days. The strikes come just a day before France's annual school summer holidays. In recent months, several European countries have experienced strikes over pay, working conditions, and soaring cost of living. Algeria is commemorating the 60th anniversary of its independence from the French colonial rule with a large military parade. Several heads of state from neighboring countries arrived in Algeria ahead of the celebration, which is the first of its kind in 30 years. The North African country, freed from France's colonial rule and gained independence after an 8-year war, hundreds of thousands of Algerians lost their lives after France launched a war on the independence movement. France, which ruled the country for 132 years, has so far refused to apologize for crimes committed during its colonial era. In Ukraine, officials are calling on civilians in the eastern city of Slavyansk to urgently evacuate as Russian troops continue to advance to secure the entire Donbass region. Slavyansk has become a new battleground just days after Russian troops took control of the neighboring Luhansk province. Local officials say Russian forces have been shelling the city chaotically over the past couple of days, mostly targeting civilian areas. The governor of Donetsk says the city is now within the range of Russian multiple rocket launchers. In an attack on Tuesday, at least two people were killed and seven others injured, some of them seriously. Russia consistently denies it targets civilians. Donetsk province is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. Together, Luhansk and Donetsk form the Donbass region, which has witnessed deadly conflict between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian groups in the past. Fighting rages on in eastern Ukraine as Russian forces keep advancing to take the Donbass region. Johnny Miller is in Donbass, where he reports how civilians fall victim to shelling by the Ukrainian army.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for 3 straight days. We traveled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets like this are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are NATO doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in the basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage. A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road. Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier. A shell landed here, pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window. She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window. Now, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves as they've been incoming here. We heard the explosion a little bit, we're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now we were going to try and find the woman, the two people killed, or relatives of them, but frankly my team has said we've got to get out of here as it's just too dangerous. At the market, the anger amongst these people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years. And it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. 3 were killed yesterday, 5 the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
One more Palestinian falls victim to Israeli gunfire as the regime's forces intensify crackdowns in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 20-year-old Rafi Riad Ghanem was shot during an Israeli raid on a village south of the city of Jenin. The victim was standing in front of his home when targeted and then detained, along with another youth. Ghanem later succumbed to his injuries. Israeli forces carry out deadly raids in the occupied territories on an almost daily basis. The flashpoint city of Jenin has become a center of resistance in the wake of repeated attacks by Israeli settlers and forces there. Earlier, our correspondent Mona Kandil gave us more details on the latest deadly Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin.
I have to mention that the Israeli military declared that one of the main reasons for raiding Jenin is to arrest well-known wanted Palestinian fighter. His name is Ahmed Ersan. He was a former Palestinian prisoner, and when he was released by the Israeli forces, he was wanted, and the Israeli military was also chasing him. They arrested him this morning, Ahmed Ersan, 24 years old, from Jenin. Not only this, what happened this morning, today we are speaking about over 40 Palestinians were detained, not only in Jenin, 30 of them were arrested by the Israeli forces in Silwad. And we have to say that Silwad, in the last few weeks, we have been witnessing the clashes and more, let's say, anti-Israel operations being carried out by Palestinians also originally from Silwad. So the main aim for the Israeli military today is to continue raiding the areas where the homeland of Palestinians who carried out anti-Israel operations or are engaged in the different forms of resistance, like Jenin and Silwad today.
Iran has voiced its support for security and stability in Uzbekistan following a deadly unrest in the Central Asian country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a phone call with his Uzbek counterpart, denounced as unacceptable any move that damages Uzbekistan's unity. Last week, the country's autonomous Karakalpakstan region was the scene of protests against planned constitutional reforms. Following the protests, President Shavkat Mirziyoyev withdrew from his plans to amend articles on the region. Status analysts believe the developments in Uzbekistan are the continuation of tensions heightened in the Central Asian region by the current U.S. administration under President Joe Biden. Observers view the protests in Kazakhstan, tensions between Tajikistan and Afghanistan, as well as the ouster of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan as part of Washington's new project to create chaos in Russia's backyard and counter China's Silk Road project. Well, July 6 marks the anniversary of a deadly U.S. airstrike on a wedding ceremony in eastern Afghanistan, but that is not the only such attack during 20 years of the U.S. military presence in the country. The U.S. military had used drones under the pretext of targeting militants, but facts on the ground showed civilians were the main victims. In this edition of News Review, we've discussed U.S. crimes in Afghanistan. Hello and welcome. On this segment of the program, July 6 marks the anniversary of a U.S. airstrike on a wedding ceremony in eastern Afghanistan. The attack killed 47 civilians, including the bride. Rahmatullah Bhagwan reports from Kabul.
On July 6, 2008, a U.S. airstrike in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province turned a wedding into carnage. These people were walking the bride to the groom's house when they were hit by the U.S. missiles. The attack left 47 Afghan civilians dead, including women and children. 14 years on, relatives of the victims say they are still grieving their losses in what they call a horrific and unjustified attack.
It was the wedding of son of Malik Zareen in August village. At around 5 in the morning, our relatives were escorting the bride to the groom's house when they were hit by 3 back-to-back airstrikes. It was a very shocking incident.
The attack stoked anger among Afghans. At that time, the Afghan government tasked a group of lawmakers and experts with investigating the incident. A member of that group says that all of the victims were civilians. He says no U.S. military personnel were punished for the killing.
The U.S. bombarding the bride's caravan was a huge tragedy and a humanitarian catastrophe. Dozens of innocent Afghans were killed or wounded. Unfortunately, the U.S. Air Force personnel involved in that attack were not probed. The Afghan people were asking why the U.S. should kill women, men, and children at a wedding. But the U.S. didn't even respond to the questions. Then, Afghan government also failed to hold the U.S. forces accountable since they were puppets of the West.
After decades of war on Afghanistan, the U.S. and allies hastily abandoned the country in August 2021. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, night raids, and mass killings. The 20-year invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S. has left Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People here say they will neither forget nor forgive the U.S. crimes and its rights violations in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent in Kabul, Abdullah Amirzadeh, and also author and historian, Marcus Papadopoulos, is joining us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Abdullah in Kabul. The story of the Afghan wedding was not, of course, a solitary case. There have been many other similar cases. A U.S. drone strike wiped out an entire family in Kabul during that chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. But there's so much impunity here, and military personnel are almost never held accountable for their wrongdoings. Why is that?
Well, yes, actually, if we are going to talk about that, accountability needs a response. If Americans hold themselves accountable for what they have done in Afghanistan or any other countries that have the same situation like Afghanistan, they must respond somehow, to some extent. For example, if they have done many brutal things here, they have destroyed infrastructures here, in response to their accountability, they must build this country, for example. And there is not just Afghanistan. We could bring more examples like Iraq or any other countries that have been invaded by the United States in the past several decades. So they know if they hold themselves accountable, they must respond. And if they respond to one country, there would be a line of other countries who would come and say, you are also responsible for what you have done in my country.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Officials should have both piety and purity and expertise and competence. Commitment to Islamic values as well as expertise. These are dualisms that some people try to set against one another before or in the beginning of the revolution, but Imam harmonized and brought them together. These are the characteristics of Imam's school of thought. Well, you may ask a question here, asking to what extent Imam's school was realized in his own time or will be realized in the future. This is an important question that others may also pose to us. I'd say, based on reliable information and a study about the realities of the country, that we have made good achievements in all these areas. If someone denies these achievements, they are definitely being unfair.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We have had many accomplishments in all these areas, including democracy, scientific achievements, diplomatic issues, the status of the country in the world, the economy and public services. Of course, we have also had our share of failures. We have had both achievements and failures and weaknesses. Here too, Imam was provided intelligent guidance for us. Imam's guidance is of huge help to us. In the last year of his life, he said something to the children of martyrs. He said, "Your performance sheet depends on your effort and diligence. The more you work and try, the more results you will achieve." Imam continued, "Living in today's world is living in the school of willpower. Life depends on willpower. Whenever the nation and officials enter the field with firm willpower, they will succeed. And whenever willpower becomes shaky and efforts decrease, there will be backwardness." Yes, we have had some failures and some achievements. This is a matter related to us. We officials and the masses of people in society were involved in all matters. In certain cases, we acted well and made achievements, and in certain cases, we showed negligence and laziness and weakness, and we naturally fell behind.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, which requires the full or partial disclosure of previously unreleased information and documents controlled by the U.S. government upon request, offers the first official confirmation of Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple countries. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allows U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. And now, the report indicated that American troops conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world between 2017 and 2020. The document also shows that at least 14 127E programs were also active in West Asia and the Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. Separately, Joseph Vatel, a retired four-star army general who headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in West Asia, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E so-called counter-terrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen.
The actual main purpose of U.S. Special Forces is to train and educate foreign fighters, and so they've done this in places that we would never that the United States people would never support in Africa, Central America, and places like that. And in fact, we created the School of the Americas, which trained Central American people to how to torture people properly.
The 127E program, an obscure program that even U.S. lawmakers are not familiar with, one that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by, with, and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. But all this only seems to be another term for waging a proxy war in another country through the use of local forces. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support militants there. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known as Section 1208, the authority was deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion, according to a former senior defense official. It was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, Section 127E. But so far, the U.S. waging of proxy wars and its use of local forces to achieve its aims have been costly for countries targeted by Washington.
I guess I would use the example of the Philippines, where Duterte, who was a very right-leaning president, kicked the United States Special Forces out, even though they were operating in his space. In support of what he was doing, he kicked them out because he just didn't want that element in his country. American foreign policy is insane in every way that it possibly can be.
Critics in the U.S. have also contended that, due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders, on the other hand, claim it is crucial to combating terrorism. But so far, the U.S.'s proxy wars in most countries where this program has been implemented, including West Asian nations like Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Lebanon, have mostly been witnessing instability, which is more likely than not a direct result of the program and proxy elements and fighters. Racist policies are enshrined in Israeli law, however, one specifically denies 6 million Palestinians the right to return to the territory from which they were expelled only a few decades ago. The same law, however, permits Jews across the world to settle in any part of Palestine. Such practices, including the racial fragmentation of Palestine into zones of control, where half of the population enjoys full rights of citizenship denied to the non-Jewish half, have led most human rights groups and advocates to label Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, Israel continuously and explicitly rejects international consensus and seems to have found strong support for their radical position from the Texas Republican Party in foreclosing any chance of a Palestinian state from ever being established.
Violence and instability are perhaps a good thing because violence implies that there will be resistance to this land grab and this denial of Palestinian rights. And as far as I'm concerned, the more resistance, the better. And Palestine needs to do resistance, and it needs its friends and allies to participate in resistance. I know that the policy of Iran and Syria and some other nations is to support Palestine in this kind of resistance. And in fact, it is now going in the direction that the entire world is saying, well, we're not going to listen to the United States anymore and NATO, for example, because the United States has now declared sanctions against so many countries that the those countries are unifying amongst themselves to defy the United States. So we may be entering a new period when, unfortunately, violence, but resistance, and most likely violent resistance, is the only answer to the warmongers.
Though party platforms do not necessarily translate into government policy, critics cite the former U.S. President Donald Trump and the support enjoyed by Israel amongst powerful religious figures, as well as fringe elements in the U.S. society, to argue that the most extreme and rejectionist views about the apartheid have become normalized in U.S. politics. In further signs that support for Israel has morphed into an extremist position in the U.S., the Texas Republican Party has approved a platform that will make it illegal to create a Palestinian state in territories controlled by Israel. The platform, approved by 5,100 delegations in Houston, supports the prohibition of a Palestinian state within the so-called historical borders of Israel, as they claim it would jeopardize Israel's security. This platform, in essence, only lays the groundwork for further Israeli aggression and discrimination against Palestinians. Currently, as many as 12 million people reside in historic Palestine, but full rights are granted by the regime to Jews only, leaving the remaining 6 million non-Jews prone to various forms of racial discrimination depending on their place of residence. But does this type of platform represent the thinking of the U.S. as a whole when it comes to Palestinians, that they shouldn't have a right to their own land?
The United States has a long tradition of denying people their land rights and their homeland. We've done it to 500 nations in North America. So this is not at all surprising that they would say that the Palestinians should be denied their homeland. At the same time, the Zionists are immensely powerful and have powerful friends in the United States. So, particularly in the power structure and the political structure.
All this poses some serious question about the future of Palestinians in light of the U.S. and Israeli plots amid what seems to be international silence over the matter.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital Madrid to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth, to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: يا ابن آدم، كن وصي نفسك في مالك، واعمل فيه ما تؤثر أن يعمل فيه من بعدك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said, O son of Adam, be your own representative in the matter of your property, and do about it whatever you want to be done with it after your death.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that one of the things which is a little bit hidden regarding the life and the universal persona of Imam Ali is the fact that he was wealthy. Now, the reason that this fact seems to be hidden from many people is because we tend to focus primarily upon the fact that Imam Ali's clothes were patched, Imam Ali's sandals were torn, and there weren't that many luxuries, if any at all, in the house. But this does not mean that Imam Ali alayhi salam was not wealthy. In reality, Imam Ali gave his wealth on the path of Allah for the sake of Allah. And so this is the perfect example of one who has been able to acquire wealth, but then gives it upon the path of Allah. And on the other hand, we have individuals who, rather than spending from what they have on the path of Allah, they decide to amass wealth, especially to the detriment of others. But even if it wasn't a detriment to others, amassing wealth is something which is looked down upon. Imam Ali says that those who amass wealth are dead, even though they may be living, while those endowed with knowledge will remain as long as the world lives. Their bodies are not available, but their figures exist in the heart. In such an amazing way, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that if you amass wealth, you are considered to be dead. Why do you continue to amass wealth? And why is this idea of the dead here being referred to? Well, the people that are alive do not receive any kind of benefit from someone who is dead. And likewise, one who amasses wealth, the people that are around him, they do not receive any kind of benefit. And so, yes, one who amasses wealth is considered to be dead. But who are the ones that are considered to be living? And they are considered to be living as long as the world lives? They are those who have been endowed with knowledge. And even though their bodies are not available, their figures exist in the hearts. One such example, dear friends, is the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, alayhi salam, who, despite his body not being available, and not just his body and physical presence is not available, for thousands of years, but we find that he lives in the hearts of every single believer, and as long as the world lives, the knowledge endowed by Allah to Imam Ali, alayhi salam, will live just as long. A very beautiful, interesting lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك.
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lean on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear. and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits a supplication to thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Whilst inside the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the visitor is recommended to busy themselves and engage with the remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether it's through the recitation of the Quran or through a number of important supplications, invocations and ziyaras that indeed establish this connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the remembrance of the Ahl al-Bayt. Here, for example, we are in the Sahan, or the courtyard, so to speak, of Sayyida Fatima within the shrine of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And a visitor here is recommended to recite a number of supplications and ziyaras. One could recite Dua al-Sabah, the supplication for the morning from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, or Ziyarat Ashura, Ziyarat Warith, Ziyarat al-Jami' al-Kabira, Hadith al-Kisa, دعاء كميل بن زياد, دعاء الندبة, دعاء السمات, دعاء التوسل, the مناجات of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. This and many other supplications are highly recommended. But of course, one of the most crucial is one that is referred to as Ziyarat Aminullah. And the Ziyarah continues until the dua begins. Allahumma inna قلوب المخبتين إليك واليها. O Allah, the heart of a mukhbit is yearning towards you. Now, a mukhbit is somebody whose heart trembles when they remember Allah. It is a state of humility and tawadhu and khushu'. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُخْبِتِينَ, the Quran says. وَسُبُلَ الرَّاغِبَيْنِ إِلَيْكَ شَارِعَ, that the way of those who seek you are established. وَعْلَامَ الْقَاصِدِينَ إِلَيْكَ وَاضِحَ, and the means of those who are looking for you is crystal clear. Then at the end, it says, اللَّهُمَّ فَاسْتَجِبْ دُعَائِي, Ya Allah, accept my supplication and my devotion. وَاجْمَعْ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَ أَوْلِيَائِي, and bring me closer to those whom I love. the Holy Ahlul Bayt, those whom I've displayed highest levels of loyalty and allegiance, بحق محمد وعلي وفاطمة والحسن والحسين, by the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, والحسن والحسين, إنك ولي نعمائي ومنتهى مناي وغاية رجائي في منقلبي ومثواي. This particular supplication is truly wonderful and mesmerizing. And the visitor lives